The following program is produced and paid for by Temple Emmanuel.
I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Professor Joseph Regenstein, the 2011 Bill Gray Scholar and the distinguished expert on food science and the leading authority on the preparations necessary for food being acceptable to both Jews and Muslims. He'll be discussing the ethics of eating in both traditions. We'll also have visits from our two Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our maven on Israel, Guy Gilbert. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. Two Jewish is sponsored this morning by Temple Emmanuel, a Reformed Jewish community for all of Tucson. Call 327-4501 for information on Arizona's finest synagogue, the only full-service Reform congregation in southern Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. As we mark 3 weeks since the terrible shooting here in Tucson, certain truths begin to accumulate about the attack and about the aftermath. First, Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords faces a very long and difficult path to recovery. She's now in a rehabilitation hospital in Houston, and our prayers continue with her. Second, the initial responses after the attack are now coalescing into actual concepts and positions and may eventually become programs and policies, kind of the natural course of events. And third, the attention of the world on this awful event and its aftermath will fade. In fact, has already faded, and any lessons of this tragedy must be learned and institutionalized quickly, or they will be lost. Which is to say, if we want to learn anything important from this horrific event, we're going to have to do so quickly. As it says in Pirkei Avot, the ethics of our ancestors, Im lo achshav ematai, if not now, when? And if we wish any good to come out of this, we're going to have to act now, more or less. So what do we now know about this attack, and what can we learn from it? Well, the act itself was perpetrated by a man who seems to be clearly insane, legally or not, perhaps schizophrenic, and seeking to find out the logic of his motivations is hopeless. If you recall, when John Hinckley shot then-President Ronald Reagan, he did so in order to try to impress actress Jodie Foster. Jared Loughner is no more sane than Hinckley was, perhaps less. He shot, killed, and maimed people with no moral compunction, and he will be treated by the legal authorities in a severe manner. But we will not learn anything important about his reasoning, because there is nothing important to learn about his reasoning. Reasoning, after all, is not his strong suit. Next, the climate of heightened hostility to politicians and the amorphous perceived evil of government definitely had something to do with creating a climate in which such an attack could take place. Back in November, I had a discussion with Gabby Giffords personally about the vitriolic ads, placards, signs, and stories attacking her that were appearing everywhere in the last days of her congressional reelection campaign. There is, of course, a long and vicious history of mudslinging in American political campaigns going back to the earliest days of our republic. But the unremitting anger that we have seen expressed publicly, the crudeness of web postings, like the lamentable Sarah Palin's gun crosshairs on Gabby Giffords' district, and the high-pitched, angry nastiness of some radio talk show hosts, of which I am one, I suppose, although I really don't think I sound like Rush Limbaugh or Glenn Beck, and the freedom grown-ups give themselves to casually and viciously slander public figures, all of these contribute to an atmosphere that literally can be toxic. We used to have, at times, a kind of recognition of the value of civility in America. I believe that we are realizing now that we need to recover that and reinforce it greatly in speech and action. As I was leaving a hospital from visiting a member of my congregation and a friend of mine, a Catholic Monsignor, was entering, he said to me, "You know, with all these events, where evil exists, grace abounds. Lots of good is coming out of all this." I'm not sure, But I am sure that a greater level of grace and respect for one another can make it much harder for evil to flourish or even exist. We are coming to understand that different ideas have to be expressed respectfully, that we are a family, not a collection of enemies, and that the temperature of the discourse in our society needs to be dramatically lowered. We can disagree with our governmental representatives without accusing them of treason or treachery or malfeasance or criminal activity. We can disagree with each other without resorting to personal attacks, verbal or physical. We can have a society that is free and open and also civil and respectful. And now, after the Tucson attacks, we must. And God willing, we will. To play us in on the theme of unity and respect this morning, here's Ehinei Matov, how good it is and how pleasant for us to live together, in the Abu Yudaya tradition from the Jews of Uganda.
Laba wekulio kulungi wekusanyusa Abo Luganda okutula Laba wekulio kulungi wekusanyusa Abo Luganda okutula Hine matovu umanaimu Cheveti ahim gamu ya hadu Ine matovu umanaimu Cheveti ahim gamu ya hadu Laba wekulio kulundi wekusanyusa Abo Luganda okutula Laba wekulio kulundi wekusanyusa Abo Luganda okutula Ine matovu umanaimu Cheveti ahim gamu ya hadu Ine matovu umanaimu Cheveti ahim gamu ya hadu.
That was Hine Matov, how good it is and how pleasant it is for us to be together in unity, from the Abu Yudaya, the Jews of Uganda. When we return in a few moments on Two Jewish, we'll meet our guest, Professor Joseph Regenstein, the distinguished food scientist and a leading authority on religious preparation standards for food for Orthodox, Conservative, and Reform Jews, and Muslims as well. Find out what the ethics of eating involves when we come back on Two Jewish.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace, but sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114.
Hi, Joe Spina, Mama's Pizza. You hear a lot of people say consistency is a good thing. After all, some places have built their reputations on consistency. Well, I got to tell you, consistency can also mean mediocrity. If you want something to be great, it has to go through an evolution. That's why at Mama's, if we find a better tomato, we'll use it. Cheese is the same way. A cow eats grain during the winter. In the spring, he's outside eating grass. What we do at Mama's is look for the best there is and go with it. All this goes to show that at Mama's, we don't strive for consistency, except that we want to consistently be the best. Come on into Mama's and find out more about our theory of pizza evolution. It's not controversial, but it's real tasty. Mama's Pizza, 4500 East Speedway in the Midway Business Park, on the east side of 22nd and Cobb and back at the Fry Shopping Center, on the north side at the southwest corner of Oracle and McGee, and our newest at Broadway and Houghton. Now repeat after me, Mama's Pizza!
We're delighted to welcome our guest on Two Jewish this morning, Dr. Joe Regenstein. He's the professor of food sciences in the Department of Food Science at Cornell University. He also has an appointment in the field of international development and is an adjunct professor in the Department of Population Medicine and Diagnostic Sciences in the College of Veterinary Medicine. I have a question. You are also a member of the Program of Jewish Studies. Is there any department that you are not a member of at Cornell University?
We have a lot of departments. Many of them are not included on that list.
Well, you have done a remarkable amount of work on both kosher and halal, that is what we would call, as Jews, kind of Muslim kosher food preparation and certification in a variety of areas. What got you interested in this initially?
I was always interested. I grew up in a home where my mother came from an Orthodox background and my father came from a very non-practicing background, and so it was always sort of in the background. My mom always discussed it, and when we got married, my wife came from a kosher home, and so we started doing kosher in the Boston area, and the folks at Brandeis would occasionally ask a question, but I was in a Jewish community. It was very easy. When I got to Cornell, where you had many fewer people practicing and where I was then in meat science and started to attend the lectures in the course I was giving some lectures in. And when the professor did a course, a lecture on kosher slaughter, I was just fascinated. And I looked out at the class and the rest of the class didn't know what he was talking about. He'd introduced it, Jews keep kosher, and this is how they kill animals. And then he went right into real technical details. So I said something, and he said, well, why don't you give the lecture? And that's how I got involved in this arena. Eventually tried to write a paper, because professors are in the publish and perish business. And once there was a paper out there, it was like the world discovered there was somebody in academia to deal with all kinds of issues that actually come up in the world of kosher, and then eventually halal. And it has just grown by leaps and bounds and almost engulfed me in various activities way beyond anything I ever expected.
I should note that you are a member, you assist the commission of the conservative movement that's developing a kind of ethical kashrut service, which has just begun official work, I think, the Magen Tzedek mark. And you've worked as well. You must be the only person who has been on the Kashrut Subcommittee of the Committee of Law and Standards of the Rabbinical Assembly, the Conservative Movement, and the Technical Committee of the Islamic Food and Nutrition Council. Is there anybody else who shares that?
Not that I'm aware of. And that's one of the advantages of coming at kosher and halal from a somewhat nonpartisan academic point of view. I work mostly with the Orthodox and even the fervently Orthodox communities, though I have actually worked a little bit with the Reforms Commission on Kashrut. My own roots are in the conservative movement, but the Muslim community has accepted me quite well, both here in the U.S., which is the Ithanka, but also internationally. I work very closely with the Muslim Council of Britain, the Halal Development Corporation in Malaysia, and the International Halal Integrity Alliance, which also comes out of Malaysia. So I've had some very interesting experiences being often the only non-Muslim in a Muslim audience. One of the more interesting ones was giving a talk at the mosque at the East End of London as a guest of the Muslim community. That's a mosque that has sometimes been more controversial in political issues, but I was there clearly representing both communities and was treated extremely well. So that's kind of a interesting position to be in.
Boy, unique position. We will talk much more with Dr. Joe Regenstein about kashrut and halal and how the Oreo cookie became kosher when we come back on Two Jewish in a little bit.
Choosing the proper care for your mother, father, or other loved one isn't easy. David Shackman and his wife, Ann, are New Yorkers who recently found a home at Handmaker, Tucson's premier provider of assisted living and senior care.
I'm 88 years old. My wife is 86. And we like staying at Handmaker because people here are very courteous and the atmosphere is nice.
Well, I like the program here because they have entertainers, have a bingo. They made a luau with Hawaiian dances.
Handmaker gives their son, Ken, peace of mind.
I know that they are going to get good service and the staff will treat them as friends.
Handmaker, centrally located on Rosemont just south of Grant, includes one and two bedroom suites, cozy studios with patios and balconies, and Tucson's most caring staff. Call 881-2323.
The food here is excellent. It's as good as any good restaurant in New York City.
For a consultation and tour, call 881-2323 or go to handmaker.org.
You are what you eat. So what does that mean for your morality? Do the choices you make about food affect your ethics? And can food standards unite Jews and Muslims as nothing else does? These and other questions will be answered by Dr. Joseph Regenstein, the outstanding authority on religious requirements for food, who will explore the ethics of eating at the premier Jewish educational event in Southern Arizona, the 2011 Bill Gray Lectureships of Temple Emmanuel. On Thursday, February 3rd at 7 p.m. at Hillel at the University of Arizona, Professor Regenstein will speak on everything you always wanted to know about kosher and halal but were afraid to ask. Then, on Friday, February 4th at 7:30 p.m. at Temple Emmanuel, he'll tell the whimsical story of how the Oreo cookie became kosher. And then, Saturday, February 5th at noon at the Rabbi's Tisch during a kosher and moral lunch, he'll explore the ethical treatment of food workers and animals. All the events are free and open to the public, except for the Friday night dinner, which has a charge. Call 327-4501 for more information about the ethics of eating at Temple Emmanuel. That's 327-4501.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or kvel, email us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or call 520-327-4501 or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can also get CDs of past and present shows through the website or downloading our podcast from there or the Apple iTunes store where you can subscribe.
Hooray for Hollywood! That's gooey, bally, hooly, Hollywood. Where any office boy or young mechanic can be a panic with just a good-looking pan.
And any shop girl can be a top girl if she pleases the tired businessman.
Hooray for Hollywood!
The 2011 Oscar nominations came out this week for movies made last year, and yet again, Jews are featured prominently in nearly every category of excellence in motion picture creation. Reminds me of the joke that was delivered last year at the Oscars ceremony. Comedian Steve Martin announced then that the 2010 Best Supporting Actor winner Christoph Waltz from the film Inglourious Basterds had played a Nazi who was hunting for Jews. He then paused dramatically, panned the huge room and said, "Well, Christoph, look around here. The mother load!" Although we Jews invented Hollywood, it's still always a pleasant surprise to see just how many prominent Oscar nominations go to Jewish stars and films these days. While the 2011 nominations are not quite as Jewish as the 2010 nominations were, there are plenty of mazel tovs to go around here, too. For Best Picture, the Coen brothers' film True Grit looks like a top contender. Really was a great movie. And if it is considerably less thematically Jewish than last year's A Serious Man, the Coen brothers definitely continue their run atop Hollywood with 10 Oscar nominations. For Best Actor and Actress, Jesse Eisenberg, the riveting star of the outstanding front-running film The Social Network, got a nomination, as did Natalie Portman, the lovely and talented star of Black Swan. All three films, True Grit, The Black Swan, and Social Network, were also nominated for Best Picture. Black Swan's filmmaker is David Aronofsky, the Jewish director who made the fascinating mystical Gematria movie Pi a few years back. James Franco, the Jewish actor who played the hiker who cut off his own arm to save his life in the movie 127 Hours, was also nominated for Best Actor. And the screenwriting categories were dominated by Jews. Aaron Sorkin for The Social Network, David Seidler for The King's Speech, Deborah Granik for Winter's Bone, the Coen brothers for True Grit, Stuart Blumberg for The Kids Are All Right. I hated that film, by the way. Anyway, and more. I guess it's probably unnecessary to say this, but Jewish success in Hollywood remains a constant.
You ought to be in pictures. You're wonderful to see. You ought to be in pictures. Oh, what a hit you would be.
And so on behalf of all Jews, I'd like to thank the Academy. Or is that self-referential? We welcome our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbart. Good morning, Guy.
Good morning, Rabbi.
It's been a traumatic but important case. Moshe Katsav, the former president of Israel, the president is the formal head of state, not the head of government in Israel, was convicted recently on a series of charges of harassment, rape even, and he's going to jail. What does that say about Israel?
Well, first of all, I think we should say out loud what Moshe Katsav did was terrible, and I'm personally I'm very happy that he's being convicted and will be punished for what he did. I think an interesting perspective is to look at the fact that a president was investigated and was charged and found guilty, which means that Israel is much more a democratic country than some people would like us to think. I would like to point out that at the court where he was convicted, there were three judges sitting on this case. The head judge, named George Kara, is an Arab Christian from Yafo. The two other judges are women judges in Israel. If you would look at the Middle East, you will not find in any other country in the Middle East those examples of a judge that comes from a minority group, of judges that are women. And certainly you won't find a case where a president is being trialed and found guilty. So I think in general, despite the case that what he did is terrible and is disgraceful, the fact that Israel as a country was able to investigate, to find him guilty and to punish him, and the specific judges that sat on this case, is saying a lot about Israel as a liberal and democratic country.
You know, there's an interesting article published this last week or so ago in a Saudi newspaper by a Saudi writer saying that Israel is ahead of all the Arab Muslim countries in government accountability. It mentioned Netanyahu's salary being published in the paper with deductions taken out for his personal expenses. And it mentioned Olmert being convicted for, you know, taking $150,000 in contributions and stuff. And they surely could have mentioned Katsav, too, that there's a transparency, not always, but an awful lot of the time in Israel. There's an accountability that speaks well for Israeli democracy.
I truly think so. And I also think that it shows that the Israel democracy allows all groups of society to take part in the democratic doing in Israel.
Yeah, it doesn't mean we don't have people who do wrong, but it means they're held up to the letter of the law. There's a rule of law in Israel.
Yeah, and everybody is equal when they stand in front of the law.
Thank you, Guy. We'll talk next week.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week. We visit weekly with the great restaurateur, Janos Wilder of Janos Restaurant at the J Bar. Good morning, Janos.
Good morning, Rabbi. Please forgive me.
Oh, well, you know, I'm in that business.
I've opened another restaurant.
Downtown?
Downtown Kitchen and Cocktails, 135 South 6th. I got to tell you, I am so excited about it. We have created an absolutely gorgeous space where the former Barrio Grill was located. And the food, well, you know my food.
Your food is the best I've ever had. Don't tell my wife. Although she agrees. So you're creating magic food, as she calls it, downtown. What's the best way for people to make reservations to try the new place?
Just give us a call at 623-7700 or go online at downtownkitchen.com. We're serving lunch Monday through Saturday, dinner 7 days a week, happy hour, late night Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, and all with prices so low, you can afford to eat here every day.
I would love to. Thanks, Janos.
Thank you, Rabbi.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community.
Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We've been talking about South America, South American Jewish communities. Really, all of Latin America has had Jewish communities going back to the 16th century. Some have grown at later times, influxes that came from Eastern Europe before World War II, couldn't get anywhere else. They went to Argentina. They went to other places in Latin America. There are significant Jewish communities really all over Latin America. You had an interesting incident, I think, in Chile.
Right. I was in Santiago de Chile, which is a city much larger than I expected, something like 6.5 million people in Santiago, greater metropolitan Santiago, and a huge number of five-star high-rise hotels, and a growing number of such hotels, because unlike much of the rest of the Western Hemisphere, Santiago doesn't seem to have had much of a recession. It seems to be kind of a boom town. And, of course, the Jewish community there is thriving along with everybody else. So I arrived in Santiago de Chile on the 23rd of December, and I was there till the 27th. So I watched as the city sort of slowly rolled up the sidewalks in the afternoon of the 24th of December, and slowly reopened things the evening of the 25th, and even more things on the 26th. But when I got back to my hotel on Saturday night, the 25th, Christmas Day, got back fairly late after dinner, maybe 10:30, I saw people first gathering for a Jewish wedding celebration, presumably like the party, dinner, reception, not the actual marriage, in my hotel, which had a huge function area and presumably kosher catering, because all these people were wearing kippot and, you know, the names were like Rosenthal and Shevchenko, whatever. So I found myself asking a question that has bothered me before, but I never thought about it in such stark terms. So here were Jews getting married, and to celebrate their happiness, they were making non-Jews, in fact, mostly Catholics, work on Christmas Day to set up the tables and the chairs and prepare this big event. Now, arguably, you know, and I'm sure some of these Jews would say, well, it's giving them work that they might not otherwise have. They might not be full-time employees, it might be part-time employees, whatever, but you know, it raised for me the whole question of not necessarily moral or legal issues, but sort of manners or derech eretz, the sensitivity of making non-Jews work on days that are important to them in terms of their religion, the way over the centuries they may have made us work on days that are important to us. And then I thought of the traditional institution of a Shabboskoy, and I wondered what your take on this whole complex of issues is, and what the legal or the Talmudic take on a Shabboskoy is, and all of that. So if you're willing to discuss that next week, maybe we...
I think I can't answer it in the 5 seconds we have left of airtime, but I would be delighted to talk about it next week, because it really is an interesting subject, and it's not quite what people think it is.
It's not cut and dried, I know, and I look forward to hearing your views on this, because I was actually kind of disturbed by what I saw in Santiago de Chile.
So. From Chile to Shabboskoys, we cover everything on Too Jewish. We will talk next week. Thanks, Tom.
I look forward to it.
And now it's time for the old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. A Catholic priest, an evangelical preacher, and a rabbi used to meet for lunch regularly. All agreed that preaching wasn't really so hard. Human beings were easy to convince. A true challenge would be to successfully preach to a bear. And so they each decided to go to the woods, find a bear, preach to it, and attempt to convert it. Then they'd reunite for their regular lunch and compare notes. Well, when they came back together, Father Flanagan's arm was in a cast, and he said, "I read to the bear from the catechism. Well, that bear was tough. He started to fling me about, but I quickly sprinkled him with some holy water. He became as docile as a lamb. Next week, the bishop's coming to give him his first holy communion." Reverend Billy Bob was in a little worse shape. He was in a wheelchair, and he said, "I read to the bar from God's holy word. We wrestled and wrestled and end up near a creek. You know, we don't sprinkle, we dunk. I quick baptized him, and the change was a miracle. We spent the rest of the day testifying and praising Jesus." The two then looked over at the rabbi. He was in a full body cast. "Oy," said the rabbi, "in retrospect, maybe circumcision wasn't the right place to start." That was the old Jewish joke of the week. You never go wrong with a circumcision joke. Special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. Now a word of Torah. In a mitzvah that is at the heart of Jewish religious experience, in our portion of Truma this week, God commands the Israelites, "Asuli mikdash v'shachanti betocham," make for me a sanctuary and I will dwell among you. With this statement, the book of Exodus moves from practical laws to ritual ones. The plans for the creation of the tabernacle in the wilderness, first site of national worship, and the directions for building an Ark of the Covenant are explained and detailed. In order to create the new central shrine for prayer, the place where God's presence will actually be, Moses calls on the people of Israel to donate material from the best of what they have, what comes to be called a truma offering. And a remarkable thing happens. When the people are asked to donate gifts to build the holy structures needed to worship God, they come forward immediately, and they give more than is required. Moses actually has to ask the Israelites to stop bringing so much gold and silver and so many precious fabrics. This, of course, marks the first and only time in history when a temple-building campaign brought in more than was requested. May it happen again sometime soon. In any case, the word for this experience is truma, a free will offering, a gift to God out of the goodness of the heart. This generous offering is a powerful thing indeed. For when it is constructed, the tabernacle in the wilderness, built from such free generosity, immediately fills with God's presence. When we give freely of ourselves to our temples today, in time, love, care, or money, we seek to recreate that free will offering, the full gift of heart and hand of our ancestors in Moses' time. And when we succeed in doing so, we too bring God's presence and love into our own lives. The great Israeli poet Yehuda Amichai wrote beautifully and sensuously on the subject of the synagogue in his book Open, Closed, Open. "I studied love in the sanctuary of my childhood. I sang 'Come, Sabbath Bride' on Friday nights with a bridegroom's fever. I practiced longing for the days of the Messiah. I conducted yearning drills for the days of yore that will not return. The cantor serenades his love out of the depths. Kaddish is recited over lovers who stayed together. The male bird dresses up in a blaze of color, and we dress the rolled-up Torah scrolls in silken petticoats and gowns of embroidered velvet held up by narrow shoulder straps. And we kiss them as they are passed round the synagogue, stroking them as they pass, as they pass, as we pass." Yehuda Amichai's poem on the synagogue. May we find love of God and holiness in our own temple sanctuaries today. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll discuss the ethics of eating with Dr. Joseph Regenstein, the prominent food scientist, surely the only man in history to serve on the national boards of Orthodox, Conservative, and Reform Jewish Kashrut Commission simultaneously, and of the National Muslim Halal Food Preparation Board as well. Find out what it means to eat ethically when we return on Too Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
We continue with our Two Jewish Update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Riots broke out all over Egypt last week against the 30 years of Hosni Mubarak's dictatorial rule. This followed the toppling of Tunisia's dictatorship slightly earlier. It remains to be seen if this is a larger sign of regime change in the so-called secular Arab world, which is predominantly kind of pro-America, Syria excepted, or if it's just a temporary rage against the Arab machine. We will stay tuned. J Street, the liberal pro-Israel lobbying group whose founder, Jeremy Ben-Ami, was on Too Jewish a couple of weeks ago, is in the news in a controversial way. U.S. Congressman Gary Ackerman has severed ties with J Street over its call on the Obama administration not to veto a U.N. Security Council resolution condemning Israel on the settlements. As Ackerman said, after learning of J Street's current public call for the Obama administration to not veto a prospective UN Security Council resolution that, under the rubric of concern about settlement activity, would effectively and unjustly place the whole responsibility for the current impasse of the peace process on Israel, and critically would give fresh and powerful impetus to the effort to internationally isolate and delegitimize Israel. You try to say that sentence fast. I've come to the conclusion that J Street is not an organization with which I wish to be associated, said Ackerman, a New York Democrat. The decision to endorse the Palestinian and Arab effort to condemn Israel in the UN Security Council is not the choice of a concerned friend trying to help, he continued. It is rather the befuddled choice of an organization so open-minded about what constitutes support for Israel that its brains have fallen out. Ouch. America really does need a smart, credible, politically active organization that is as aggressively pro-peace as it is pro-Israel. Unfortunately, Ackerman concluded, J Street ain't it. Whew. Ackerman's agreement to accept J Street's endorsement last fall was a prize for the progressive pro-Israel group in the November elections. He is Jewish, from New York, and his pro-Israel record is considered second to none. In the last Congress, he was chairman of the U.S. House of Representatives Middle East Committee. In recent years, Ackerman has questioned what he has said were missed opportunities by the U.S. and Israel to engage with moderate Palestinians. Like other members of Congress, Ackerman was known to have come under intense pressure from some conservative pro-Israel sources, you know, like AIPAC, and donors during the election to cut off J Street. The group responded to Ackerman's goodbye statement by saying it was deeply pained and that he had misrepresented its position. We do not support a UN condemnation of Israel, endorse this resolution, they said. We have urged the United States to consider withholding its veto from a resolution criticizing Israeli settlement activity, a resolution that closely tracks the policy of the U.S. under the last eight administrations. J Street went on to give other reasons for its support for a non-veto. Well, all that might well be true, but J Street has lost its star endorsement. The Israel Antiquities Authority announced last week it had completed the excavation of an ancient tunnel that runs from the City of David in eastern Jerusalem to near the Temple Mount. Travelers making pilgrimages to Jerusalem 2,000 years ago used the road in the tunnel. It was discovered during excavations on a water channel used for drainage during the Second Temple period. Some Palestinians believe the project is an attempt to damage the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Of course, some Palestinians believe the world is flat. Uzi Dahari, the Israel Antiquities Authority's deputy director, said that there was no intention of igniting interreligious tension. Work on the tunnel took 7 years, including a year's delay after the Israeli Supreme Court ordered work halted, while it considered a petition by residents of the Eastern Jerusalem neighborhood of Silwan, who claimed the dig was damaging their homes. They decided it wasn't, and they resumed the work in September of 2009. No opening has been made on the tunnel near the Temple Mount, though one is planned. The tunnel does not run under the Temple Mount. And in diplomatic news, none of it good for Israel, Ireland became the first European Union member to upgrade its Palestinian diplomatic mission into an embassy. The head of the Palestinian mission will become an ambassador in Dublin, will present his credentials to the Irish president. The upgrade does not mean that Ireland has recognized a Palestinian state, supposedly. Israeli officials are worried that other European countries will follow suit. Spain, Belgium, and several Scandinavian countries are expected to announce their unilateral recognition of an independent Palestinian state, as 8 Latin American countries have done in the past 6 weeks, including Peru just last week. Israel expresses its regret over the step adopted by Ireland, said the Foreign Ministry of Israel, although it is not surprised by it, considering Ireland's biased policy regarding the conflict over the years. And that's the news of Jews around the world. We welcome back our guest on Two Jewish This Morning, Dr. Joe Regenstein. He is the distinguished professor, I don't know if that's the official title, but a very distinguished professor nonetheless, of food sciences, Department of Food Science at Cornell University, has appointments in a variety of other departments, is an expert on, from the academic standpoint, on both kashrut and halal and the food production required to maintain those standards, as well as a supervisory involvement. When I was growing up, if we wanted to have a good cookie with chocolate on the outside and white on the middle, we had to have the Hydrox cookies, which just didn't taste as good as Oreos, and everybody knew it. And if you were Jewish, you yearned for Oreo cookies. Tell us a little bit about how you helped the Oreo cookie become kosher.
Let me tell you a little bit about it, but I'm not going to tell the whole story because that is actually one of my talks that I will be giving when I come to Tucson shortly. But the basic start of this whole process was when the folks who are involved in Oreo's Cookie and Cream ice cream, that being the food service division of what was at that time Nabisco, which has since become part of Kraft, were interested in selling the cookie, which, when you're making it into ice cream, does not have the white filling. It's just the cookie. And, in fact, at the time, it was being made by what would be called a co-packer, that is a company other than Nabisco, was baking those cookies because they needed more of them than they had the capacity, and it was much easier to just bake the cookie. It's the filling and the special packaging and all of that that causes the special processes they need. And of course, if it's a ice cream cookie, it doesn't have to, it can also take much rougher mechanical handling. So,
since they're going to break it into the ice cream anyway, it doesn't really matter.
Yes, yeah, mechanical handling is a big word for keeping it from being broken. Thank you for that.
Sure.
And so we, I got to be talking with the woman who was the director of food service, and she had a problem. Because Oreos were not kosher, and the entire, at that time, Nabisco line was notoriously not kosher, it by then was no longer using lard, but had traditionally used lard, which obviously made it totally inappropriate for the Jewish and Muslim communities. And so they had moved to vegetables, shortening in the regular line, and as I say, the cookie specifically for the ice cream folks was being made by a co-packer, and the problem she was running into is that if you look at most national ice cream companies or even large regionals, they are all kosher, and in fact, most or many of them are under the OU, which is the largest kosher certification, the Union of Orthodox Jewish Congregations. And the OU would not permit the ice cream companies to say that they had Oreos cookie and cream ice cream, because everyone in the Jewish community knew that Oreos were not kosher.
Right.
And so how could you have a kosher Oreos cookie and cream, and how do you do that and not cause a great deal of consumer confusion? And so she was having problems with some of the ice cream companies saying, either we can use the name Oreos cookies and cream because we're paying a little bit more because we want it to be a superior product, or we're going to have to consider competitors, because how can we justify spending the extra money for Oreos if we can't tell the world we're using Oreos? And that was her problem. And so we talked about it, and the decision was that I would come down and talk to people at Nabisco, and that's how the process got started. And the details of how we then did that is one of the most complex and most interesting examples of converting a non-kosher operation to a kosher operation. And I guess I'll
save that right for the talk, so everybody has to come hear you.
Right.
I want to ask sort of two other areas. What are the congruencies between kosher, you know, Jewish kosher food preparation and Muslim halal, and what are the significant differences?
In broad terms, the way I tend to break it down is I create five categories for kosher, and then there is one additional category for halal. And so let me just walk through them fairly systematically and quickly again. I will be talking on this on Thursday night, I believe, at the university, as an open lecture for everyone. But basically, kosher has a collection of allowed animals, ruminants, birds, and fish that we're allowed to eat. And the Muslims also have a list. Theirs is broader than ours. So there are animals that Muslims will eat, such as rabbit and camel, that are clearly prohibited to Jews. But again, they're generally speaking, at least with respect to the ruminants, with the mammals, I should say, relatively herbivorous and not carnivorous animals. So they're the animals that will eat plant materials predominantly. Both groups have a strong prohibition against the pig. Interestingly, the Muslims actually, in general, have a stronger prohibition than there is actually in Orthodox Judaism, in that wearing pigskin leather is not a problem for an Orthodox Jew. It would and often is a problem for a Muslim.
Yeah, playing professional football, also a huge problem with the pigskin. So,
well, that in fact has been a very funny thing. I teach a course on kosher and halal at Cornell, and at one point I realized that one of my Muslim students was a football player, and we actually talked about it. And the interesting thing is, it may have historically at one point been made out of
pigskin. Yeah, it hasn't really been a pigskin for a long time. That's right.
It hasn't been a pigskin for a really long time. And so, in fact, he could, one, play football, though he wasn't a defensive lineman. But if, in fact, he ever had an opportunity at an interception, he didn't have to duck it just because he didn't want to touch the pigskin. So, yes, it's called a pigskin, but from a Muslim perspective, thankfully, it is not, because they would, if it were, they would be concerned. And I think at one point there was actually an incident somewhere in the world where somebody was actually using, I think it was pork leather, to make a soccer ball to be offensive specifically to Muslims.
To Muslims on purpose.
Yeah. So you have the permitted animals that the two groups don't completely overlap, but are basically selecting on the same general basis. The second is the whole area of slaughter and the prohibition of blood. Both groups slaughter the same way, with a unstunned slaughter. All of the post requirements of kosher do not exist in Islam. So once the animal is slaughtered, they turn it back over to the government, while the rabbis still want to look at the animal's insides, and then they also want to do deveining and salting and soaking. So We do more with meats, but we both share the need to kill an animal a certain way. And in fact, one of my proud achievements is that at one point we actually did a truckload of sheep and goats. Unfortunately, I was not present. Some people would say, aren't you lucky you weren't present? But unfortunately, that's part of my life dealing with slaughter. Where, in fact, the Somali Muslim community in the Midwest and the Jewish community had agreed on a set of operating principles, and we actually slaughtered the entire set of animals so that they were both kosher and halal simultaneously.
Wow.
There have been isolated kills that way, but this is the only time a whole truckload like that, you know, that I'm aware of, was killed for both communities simultaneously.
You mentioned non-stunning, and there's a growing issue, both in New Zealand and in Europe, about the kosher process for slaughter. And in New Zealand, they outlawed kosher meat for a while. Kosher chicken is still in question. Can you speak to that briefly?
I would love to speak to it, but can we kind of stay with the first question?
Sure.
And come back to it, if you don't mind, just to keep us from going off on too many tangents in too many directions. So that's item two. The separation of milk and meat, absolutely no parallel in the Muslim community. Special foods for special holidays, Passover, no equivalent in the Muslim community. On the flip side, alcohol, which has a bunch of Jewish kashrut requirements, but basically, you know, we use wine to say kaddish, if it's say kiddish, and we use wine in our cooking and so forth. Muslims, the big other area is the Muslims ban alcohol, specifically the drinking alcohol that is used, that makes one intoxicated. This is part of, they do not permit things that harm human health. Sometimes, and I think we've finally seen that in the Orthodox community, is a somewhat more negative view of smoking than we've had in the past. And the Muslims do not use alcohol, which we do use in foods. So we would use, you know, when you have vanilla flavors or lemon flavor or almond flavor, those are all extracts which are in alcohol. So one of the challenges is in the food industry is to come back to figuring out how to do things like that in a way that is compatible with Muslims who do not want you dropping in a 45% alcohol solution of vanilla into a cake or a pudding or any of those kinds of products. So at the 15,000-foot level, those are the distinctions, similarities and differences between kosher and halal.
So I want to thank, there's so much more we could talk about. I want to thank Dr. Joe Regenstein. We're out of time, but for giving us a great primer on both kashrut and halal and some of the sacred foods issues that exist today. And you can come and hear him at Temple Emmanuel coming up quite soon. Thank you so much, Dr. Regenstein.
You're most welcome.
When we come back, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out this morning on Too Jewish.
You are what you eat. So what does that mean for your morality? Do the choices you make about food affect your ethics? And can food standards unite Jews and Muslims as nothing else does? These and other questions will be answered by Dr. Joseph Regenstein, the outstanding authority on religious requirements for food, who will explore the ethics of eating at the premier Jewish educational event in Southern Arizona, the 2011 Bill Gray Lectureships of Temple Emmanuel. On Thursday, February 3rd at 7 p.m. at Hillel at the University of Arizona, Professor Regenstein will speak on everything you always wanted to know about kosher and halal but were afraid to ask. Then, on Friday, February 4th at 7:30 p.m. at Temple Emmanuel, he'll tell the whimsical story of how the Oreo cookie became kosher. And then, Saturday, February 5th at noon at the Rabbi's Tisch during a kosher and moral lunch, he'll explore the ethical treatment of food workers and animals. All the events are free and open to the public, except for the Friday night dinner, which has a charge. Call 327-4501 for more information about the ethics of eating at Temple Emmanuel. That's 327-4501.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Next week, our guest will be Misha Galperin, the president and CEO of the Jewish Agency for International Development and co-author of The Case for Jewish Peoplehood, Can We Be One? Good question. Play out this morning comes from Israeli singer-songwriter, guitarist extraordinaire David Broza. It's a love song called Srachim. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
הסתבכו לסרוכים בשיטות בדרכים כל כלב הזו היה לי כאח ואם היה עליי לעבור זאת שוב הייתי עובר זאת שוב איתך בגיל 30 החיים קשים ונפשי עוד כמה אל הרגע הרך ואם היה עליי לעשות זאת שוב הייתי עושה זאת שוב.
The preceding program was produced and paid for by Temple Emmanuel.